The Justice Appropriations Subcommittee will come to order. Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan, excused. Vice Chair Smith?
Here.
Ranking Member Valdez?
Present.
Representatives Beltran, excused. Bracy Davis?
Here.
Campbell?
Here.
Duggan?
Here.
Fabricio? Gottlieb?
Here.
Jacques?
Here.
Saroy, excused. Snyder?
Here.
Stark?
Here.
Waldron?
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
A quorum being present, I want to welcome everybody to the Justice Appropriations Subcommittee. Please ensure that your cell phones and other communication devices are turned off or in silent mode. Welcome, members. Welcome back, I guess I should say, to begin the process leading up to the 2024 legislative session. I hope everyone enjoyed their summer and is ready for another productive session. As you can see, I'm filling in today for Chair Brennan, who has a family issue, nothing medical, nothing that we should be too concerned about. But the importance of family to him and to all of us, we probably all respect that. He looks forward to working with everyone in the upcoming months. Before we begin, I'd like to remind you that we are only authorized to meet until 5 p.m. today, which is going to be very important. I would ask members to hold their questions until after the conclusion of each presentation that we have. And if we need additional information from an agency head, please follow up with them after our meeting if we can, just to get through today's presentations. Members, today we will begin hearing presentations on fiscal year 2024-25 legislative budget requests, as submitted by all agencies and departments on September 15, 2023. We will hear from four departments today and anticipate that in the upcoming subcommittee meetings, we will hear the remainder of the presentations from departments within the subcommittee's purview that we are not presenting, that are not presenting before us here today. To provide some context for the overall LBR request on a statewide basis, agencies are asking for $5.8 billion additional general revenue spending and $22.8 billion of additional trust fund spending over the base budget. Within our subcommittee, seven agencies under our jurisdiction are requesting an additional $879 million for general revenue, as well as $61 million from trust funds. As we listen to the presentations, I want to remind you about the long-range financial look that was issued earlier this fall by the Legislative Budget Commission. That outlook focused primarily on general revenue funds, and it showed that our state's budget is in good shape with positive ending balances projected for the next 3 years. Despite that good news, the outlook also revealed that projected expenditures are being outpacing revenues, particularly in reoccurring spending. Members, this means that we need to be cautious as we develop next year's budget, and we need to be mindful of out-year impacts of our spending decisions. With that context in mind, let's move right into our presentations. Presenting today on behalf of Florida Department of Corrections is Secretary Ricky Dixon. Secretary, it's good to see you back before this committee, my friend, and you are recognized.
It's good to see you, sir, and several familiar faces there that spend a lot of time in our prisons. Thank you for your understanding, your interest in the work we do, and I have such appreciation for what you just said, the revenues versus the needs of the state, and thank you for the work you do to balance that and to ensure that we can function as an agency as we should. So thank you for that. I'll jump right into a couple things before I start. I will this slide here. I'll just quickly remind everyone that I've tried to simplify the solutions to our agency's issues into three categories. Not overly complicated. We've got to address our staffing challenge, and you have knocked that out of the park 2 years in a row. We're really making great strides at most locations, but not all, and I'll address some of that this morning. Inmate idleness, I can take that off the list. Never dreamed that we would have the support in educating and programming our population that we received last year with over 200 teachers. It's going to fill every education building in the state of Florida and make tremendous differences to public safety in general for ensuring folks get a job. And then the infrastructure challenges, I'll be talking a lot about that this year. We really have to address infrastructure, and there's more than one way to do that. So we want to offer some suggestions on how we approach infrastructure challenges. Moving to the next slide, I think you're familiar with our stats. We are the third largest correction system in the nation, as would be expected with our population. And we're the largest state agency in the state in terms of employees and those in our custody. I will say this too, something I don't always mention. We also have a lot of building space. We have 21 million square feet of building space and 4,400 roofs to keep up. That would be a task for any agency, but when you have a population that you can categorize as destructive at times, living in those buildings 24/7, it takes a toll, and we've got to, again, address some of those issues. I can't start without recognizing you all, both in the House and the Senate and the governor's office, for what you have done. You've provided historic pay raises, $22 an hour for our staff, hiring retention bonuses, education, as I mentioned, raising teacher pay, and I won't read all of that, but a support like we've never seen, and Floridians should be proud and grateful for the work you all are doing in that space. So thank you. All right, so jumping into the budget, I want to start with what I consider the most important priority we have, and that is, the recognition that we still have the National Guard in our system. I wish that were not the case now, but we have to have them. We're still not staffed, even though we're recovering. The staff we're hiring have to be trained, and we're not to a point where they can go at this point. That's primarily due to about 15 to 18 prisons not recovering in the north at an acceptable pace. That's causing us to have to push the population south and over-compress inmates in the southern part of the state. It's not fair to the staff in the southern part of the state, the tremendous overtime they have to work, the unsafe conditions, while dorms are closed in the north sitting vacant because I'm not at a price point yet in terms of salary that we can fill those prisons and balance and distribute the population as we should. So a very real issue. We've already learned that the pay and the salaries make a difference in locations, so we're almost there. So we'll be asking to address that. I do want to thank General John Haas and his service members for their support. They've been phenomenal. Jumping right into the budget, for the sake of time, I have a lot. I'm going to read very fast. If you need me to slow down or clarify or stop, please let me know, but I'll try out of respect for you all and your time to go through this very fast. So our budget request includes $150.7 million to implement a retention plan that improves recruitment and retention for critical staff. I do want to note that although it's recurring, that's not $150 million every year. That's only a first-year ask. After that, it'll be around $27 million a year, so much less than this first-year ask. We devised a detailed strategy to enhance retention by offering higher incentives to eligible staff. Employees who have completed 1.5, 3 years, and 6 years would get an additive here. So that's when we lose people. We spend a tremendous amount of money on that churn, on losing and training and turning over people. Once they stay with us about 8 years, we're usually in good shape. But we recognize we lose people in those early years, so that's what this is designed around, is to target that early churn. Our second priority is to allocate $14.1 million for adding position groups to the special risk retirement category. These positions are behind the fence and require extensive daily interaction with the inmate population. I'm talking about teachers, maintenance guys, case managers, classification staff that are assaulted frequently within our prisons. And just because they don't wear the uniform, we're trying to focus on their special risk, high-risk retirement as well. We're requesting $5.8 million in pay parity for maintenance staff. Since 2020, the vacancy rate in this area has increased from 7% to 25%. Due to inadequate maintenance staff, correctional officers are often pulled from their critical security post to do maintenance functions at a higher rate of pay because of the benefit package that correctional officers receive. The pay increase that was approved during 2023 legislative session did not apply to classification officers. While the agency discretionary pay plan provided some assistance, there are still many gaps in this area that need to be addressed. To help us bridge this gap, we're requesting $7.5 million to provide a pay parity package for selected classes within the department's management and classification system. Attracting qualified staff is a challenge for classification and directly associated with security, safety, and order of the facility. The next five issues address improving our infrastructure. First, we're requesting $57.3 million to address major information technology infrastructure needs of the department. Our budget includes $23.2 million to continue the modernization of the Offender-Based Information System, otherwise known as OBIS. This is year three of a six-year project. $17.5 million to invest in a legacy application technology restoration plan. 70% of the department's applications are legacy, end-of-life, or only partially available throughout the facilities. $10 million to invest in a technology restoration plan. Now, this plan includes annual goals to expand and enhance portions of our network infrastructure and increase technical support capability through contracted services. We're asking for $3.57 million in additional authority in the administrative trust fund to provide funding to update Florida Commission on Offender Review critical applications. And finally, for IT, we're requesting $3 million to replace a portion of its 14,000 computers. Over half of the department's computers are over 5 years old and do not meet the minimum specifications needed to run the required operating system. Last on this slide, we are requesting $3.76 million to assist with routine institutional repair and maintenance. Now, to address our physical plant needs, our budget includes $105 million for capital improvements, such as new construction, repairs, renovations, and security and environmental enhancements. Every dollar of this request associated is directly linked to three specific categories, and that is the safety and security of the public, the staff, and inmates, the current dangerous living and working conditions, and failing infrastructure. We will provide an itemized breakdown linking these critical and urgent needs associated with the request for you following the presentation. Next is our community corrections firearms request. This is a $2.1 million request to provide all certified firearms carrying correctional probation officers with a state-issued firearm and holster. Am I going at an acceptable pace? I know I'm speeding through this, but okay. Our probation officers work alone, often after hours, supervising dangerous individuals in some of the most dangerous neighborhoods in our state. Currently, CPOs must purchase their own weapon, and we want to correct that. For community corrections, we've also included $757,000 for GPS electronic monitoring of community supervision offenders. Our population of GPS offenders are projected to increase by over 8% or 525 individuals in fiscal year 24-25. And $3.27 million to purchase 450 portable radios to equip every community corrections vehicle to provide probation officers with reliable communication while supervising offenders and oftentimes in remote areas. $7.8 million to provide all FDC-certified staff an adequate number of department-issued uniforms. This is inclusive of correctional officers and probation officers. This request will ensure that certified officers have a full work week of uniforms. That is not the case now. They don't even have a full week's set in many cases. I'd like to point out that many of our correctional officers and probation officers currently purchase many of their own uniforms. Additionally, our budget includes $21.2 million to allow the department to continue meeting its contractual obligations for year 205 of the Comprehensive Healthcare Services Contract with Centurion of Florida, $5.4 million to purchase additional fleet inventory, 67% of our fleet of 3,000 vehicles, which no longer meets DMC lifecycle standards. The food service contract has two related issues: price level increases for food service delivery, and that's $14.5 million, and $14.8 million request for increased food service delivery to accommodate the growing population. Regarding security operations, we've included $7.2 million to provide funding to address certified training staff to support the staffing of statewide certified trainers for security operations, $12 million for security equipment to prevent drug introductions and escape attempts in prisons, including $5.1 million for X-ray body scanners, $11.5 million to fund security officer positions in our education buildings. Thank you all so much for the support of adding the additional 200 teachers, as I said earlier. However, we need to keep them safe by providing security that we forfeited years ago when the buildings were, or the classrooms were emptied. $10 million to tackle staffing issues in two areas. $5 million is requested for the entrance and exit staff, outsourcing that staff, and another $5 million for a maintenance staff pilot program at four facilities to outsource those issues. Our budget also includes $1 million for operational support in the Bureau of Research and Data Analysis to address staffing shortages and meet demands for statistical reports from stakeholders, $897,000 to fund evidence custodians who collect evidence for criminal investigations, especially in contraband introduction cases. Our Office of the Inspector General conducts investigations and uses evidence for criminal prosecution. $6.3 million to cover inflation-related cost increases for motor fuels, electricity, inmate clothing, inmate personal care items, wastewater treatment, generator maintenance, and fire and safety equipment. $1.75 million to assist with the transition associated with the Florida Palm project. $1.2 million to convert other personnel services, or OPS positions, to FTEs. This will reduce the reliance on OPS staff working within chaplaincy services. And finally, the department is requesting $6.6 million in recurring trust fund authority in the state-operated Inmate Welfare Trust Fund to continue the improvement of inmate health and well-being, and to continue to decrease idleness and violence. The department's legislative budget request is $473 million, which is a 14% increase to the base budget, and it will be distributed as you see there on the screen. With that, I thank you again. You all have been amazing, and I appreciate the support. I know that's a lot. We have a lot of needs, and we're a big agency, and I appreciate you realizing that. And if there are no questions?
Questions? Committee members? Rep, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and hi, Secretary Dixon. Couple of questions in reference to the replacement of motor vehicles. Do we currently own those vehicles?
We do.
Has the department considered through DMS to possibly seeing if maybe leasing the vehicles versus purchasing the vehicles, and see if what kind of return on investment would that have?
We have. Those discussions have occurred, I know, in years past. I don't know if they've occurred recently. My understanding and recollection, and don't hold me to this exactly, is it was just determined that it was more advantageous from a cost perspective to go ahead and purchase those vehicles. But absolutely willing to have those conversations.
Rep. Fabrizio, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Secretary, thank you so much for your presentation today. I had the opportunity to go out and visit Columbia Correctional Institution over the break and have a tour of the facility and see some of the issues that you're discussing here today. So I do believe that these are all needed. A quick question. In regard to the National Guard's services that are being provided for the Florida State prisons, how many employees do you need to fill some of those open slots to be able to let those Florida Guardsmen go back to do Florida National Guardsmen to go back to do their regular duties?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's 2,800 vacancies right now. We would not need to fill all those to get to that point, of course. We're probably somewhere around the 1,000 mark. We think that if we hired about another 500 to 1,000, we would be in much better shape.
Follow-up.
Are you trending towards that? And if so, what's your time frame or not?
Mr. Chair?
You're recognized.
I'll try to be concise. We're doing remarkable. If you look at statewide statistics, we are really hiring fast. The problem is we're not hiring in about 15 locations, as I mentioned earlier. They're remote, rural area prisons that, for various reasons, we're just not doing as well there. That's why we're having to push those individuals south. Now, you all have provided a $5,000 additive at 15 prisons. The first of four payments went out in September. We had a record-breaking September. So if it works, we don't know the answer to that. Time will tell. But if it's successful in bringing people in those prisons, we can bring the population back north, position ourselves to, at some point, release the guard.
Thank you very much. Is there a question? All right. There we go. Rep, you're recognized. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you today for the presentation today, Secretary. I, too, have had the opportunity to tour some of the correctional institutions yesterday. I was at Santa Rosa. So thank you for this presentation. I have a couple of questions, if I may. The first question is, do you think the hiring or staffing concern could be attributed to the air condition?
You're recognized.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I say it could be attributed to conditions. Staff like comfortable work environments too, and I'm not opposed at all to air conditioning. It's just a matter of how we get there in the most cost-effective way. What I will say to your point is, if in those air-conditioned units, the behavior is normally better by the population. If the behavior is better, it creates a better work environment for the staff, not only for their comfort level, but because of the behavior in and of itself. So that lends itself to better recruitment and retention. Some of these young staff or staff of any age come and work for us, and we put them in these work environments with aging facilities, poorly conditioned officer stations, and it impacts, I think, their our recruitment and retention. I think it does.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we heard that the food contract is going to increase, and with that, does that increase the per person allotment or the budget per person because of the increase in the food contract?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
You're recognized.
It's for two reasons. There's two categories there. One category is the expected growth in the population. So we have to increase the price to handle the population growing. The second is to accommodate CPI or inflation, cost price index increases. So if we're unable to do that, it could negatively impact the meal. I won't say that doing it would make the meal better, but not doing it would certainly impact the way we have to provide the meal. And providing a good quality meal is one of the most important things we do to keep the prison safe and to keep the temperature down, so to speak, within the prison. So it's important.
One last question, Mr. Chair.
Very quickly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read an article in the Orlando Sentinel this week as it relates to commissary, and it mentioned that mail menu commissary items have increased as much by 80%. Could you speak to that at all?
Sure. It's I don't know about 80%, but it certainly increased to a point that we didn't disagree with those complaining. We think it was too high, too, for certain items that are popular. We've been in conversations, the agency, with the vendor, and I think we're about to reach an agreement that everyone's going to be pleased with to bring some of those prices down.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you.
Presenting today on behalf of the Department of Juvenile Justice is Secretary Eric Hall. Who's coming on up. And you are recognized, sir.
Thank you, Chair Smith, Ranking Member Valdez, members of the committee. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. And I want to start by really thanking all of you that had the opportunity here these last couple months to go out and visit with some of our facilities. I can tell you, for us, it's great to have you come out, meet our youth, meet our staff, meet our partners, and the work that we're trying to do to really drive our system forward. You know, many of you heard me talk in the past about how we're the largest comprehensive system in the nation for juvenile justice. And a lot of that that you're going to see today in our legislative budget request is really focused on the full continuum of work that we do at the department, from the work that we're doing on prevention to the deeper end of our system and making sure we provide a high-quality education for the youth in our residential programs. We're excited about this budget proposal and the things that we're going to be doing and continuing to build on that success. And it comes back to really aligning with our four cornerstones in our strategic plan, which is called Pathway to Impact, and it's about having world-class talent and leadership. It's about using data to drive the decisions and the outcomes that we can produce for the young people and the families that we serve, making sure that we're using effective implementation of evidence-based services and programs, and then that fourth one being around the academic achievement and post-secondary success for the youth that we serve. And to me, those are our four cornerstones, and you're going to see that reflected in the budget proposal that we have before you today. The budget that we have currently is roughly about $664 million, and what you're going to see for next year's proposal is we're going to be looking for about an additional $93 million and adding about 14 FTE to the work that we're doing. The big parts of this budget proposal that you're going to see, a lot of it is going to be focused on education, because I have to, you know, recognize the fact that, you know, we're excited about launching for the first time ever a statewide unified school system. I want to thank our two sponsors, Representative Jacques and co-sponsor Representative Valdez, for your support and the entire committee's support with what we were able to get done this last session. And to me, this is going to be a game changer. This is about how do we provide that high quality education, not just in K-12, help more of our young people get a high school diploma and have them on that pathway to academic success beyond high school with a credential or a degree that places them into a high demand career, changing the trajectory for them and for their families. So we're excited about this, but this is our implementation year. We're in the first phase of building the system out. We're looking to have the recurring allocation increase to $12.8 million when we'll be fully operational starting July 1 of 2024, basically equating to about $24.8 annual recurring. And that is about funding each and every student, and it's outside the FEFP, but built on some the funding of the FEFP. And so there's some dynamics there, but by taking it outside the FEFP, we're helping to fund also those kids that have a GED and making sure they've got that access to post-secondary credentialing. So excited about that, and again, want to thank all of you for helping support us make that happen. In this category, which is around non-secure residential, you'll see, for those of you that aren't familiar, we have two components within our residential continuum from a budget entity standpoint. Some of that is funded through non-secure, and then the other side is secure, which I'll touch on in a minute. But we are looking to add 52 beds in our non-secure settings for this upcoming budget cycle. We want to make sure that we can go back and bring some of these beds back online. About 3 years ago, we took about a $15.5 million cut in this category in our residential services. And now that we've seen courts resume and things back on track, We want to make sure that we bring those beds back online so that we can reduce any waiting lists or placements for kids that may be sitting in detention to be able to get into those beds and get services started quickly. So here you'll see about a $5.2 million increase to bring those 52 beds back online. And then with our fixed capital outlay, again, you're going to see this come across in a couple categories. Those of you that have been out to our centers, you know, we do have several of our facilities that are definitely getting up there. We haven't built new facilities in quite some time. Our providers, and something else to point out here, is that non-secure and secure residential. Those are all privately contracted provider. We put those out for bid. We procure those services. And so in this category, it's not just about having, you know, an environment that's conducive for kids. It's also making sure that we have an environment conducive to staff. I also want to pause here for a second to thank the committee and the legislature and the governor, because I can tell you when you talk about some of the staffing concerns, and I want to give Secretary Dixon and his team just a tremendous amount of credit. I think across the board, we've all seen these increases and these investments in our team members to be able to address our recruitment and retention. And I can tell you for us as a department, you know, when we were able to see the increase in salary, we've seen significant reductions, actually cutting our vacancy rates in half, going from detention officers at 41% vacancy just a couple years ago to where now we're at 19% in those detention officer positions. Probation officer positions, we were a little over 25% vacancy rates, and now we're down to 11%. So these trends for us are phenomenal because it helps us to provide services. But going back to the LBR, in this case, we were also fortunate this past year, again, with the help of the legislature, to bring the salaries up at $19 an hour for our contracted providers. And you're going to see us really come back and try to double down on some of that for some of the other areas of our system where we can address recruitment and retention needs for our partners out there in things like probation and community-based services. But I want to highlight that because here when we come back to the capital outlay discussion, we're seeing a number of challenges where I can tell you just a little over, you know, week and a half ago, we had a pipe rupture at one of our facilities. We had to turn the water off, which means I had to move all of those youth to a vacant facility that we had. And that had a number of, you know, factors that were not just impacting moving youth, but when you think about moving youth from a facility that may be in one county and have a vacant facility that may be three or four counties over, you talk about having to have staff go with those youth and supervise those youth and being away from home. That's a dynamic that is very real, which is why we got to continue to look at how do we improve our facilities when it comes to plumbing, fixtures, updating some of our bathrooms, and just, again, making sure that we've got an environment that's conducive to the safety, health, and welfare of the youth and the staff that we serve. So you're going to see fixed capital outlay here in this case of about $6.5 million to address our non-secure facilities. Switching over to the secure side now. When we talk about staffing, you know, on occasions, we have to look at how do we have team members from our Office of Residential Services go out into a facility and provide either technical assistance on site, or in some cases help to review what may be called, we call it Central Communication Center. It's when there's an incident that occurs, and let's say we have a youth-on-youth fight that takes place. Staff have to intervene and they have to separate the youth and sometimes do an escort, or in some cases maybe restrain that youth so that they're not, you know, continuing to potentially, you know, create any risk. But when that happens, sometimes those staff members are taken off duty and have to be removed until we have a team member go and review video to make sure that policies, procedures, and appropriate protocols were followed. Well, that hurts our residential providers because they got to get somebody then to cover that shift. So we're looking to add 4 FTE in this division, roughly one per region, so that we can get somebody out quickly to review those cases and help get those staff members back on the floor and close those out. And if not, make sure we respond correctly and appropriately to policy and procedure and protocol. So in this area, we do want to look at bringing, this is 4 of the 14 FTE that we talked about earlier at the beginning. And then again, fixed capital outlay, continuing to build that infrastructure. You know, I know during some of the tours, you may have seen where we have new bathrooms that were, you know, we're renovating, we're bringing those up, you know, to really what I would say is what we need to do for our kids. At the same time, when we see things around roofs, we're doing a lot of patchwork with roofs, and not unlike, you know, schools or other facility operations here in our state, during the summer we had to deploy a number of what I would call mobile air conditioning units because we had air conditioning units that were breaking down, and sometimes we're seeing it takes as long as 6 months to be able to get those parts in for replacement. So as proactive as we can continue to be in this area with that fixed capital outlay, it's a huge win for us, and it's about maintaining that continuity of operations at our facilities. With our detention centers, and I always like to, again, differentiate. You think residential, again, non-secure, secure, privately operated by contractors that we procure. In our detention centers, those are directly state employees and directly state operated. But again, same type of issues when you talk about facilities. We, Representative Valdez, I think we had an opportunity recently to tour over at Hillsborough, you know, detention center. That's where you'll see the second item. We want to look at replacing that center. That center is over 40 years old. I can tell you that we've had those pipes, even when they're trying to be repaired, they collapse. And it creates definitely operational challenges and nuances. Here, we want to be able to replace that center. And again, I want to thank the legislature and the governor because we had a little over $5 million allocated for this current year to do site planning and to come back with an assessment for 3 detention centers. We want to start with Hillsborough. And if things go according to plan, what you'll see in the future is Broward and Palm Beach as well, because those are aging facilities within our portfolio. But keeping those facilities up and running for those that we're not replacing, and then look at how do we start to have a plan in place for long-term replacement for the facilities that are getting older and really we need to look at retiring here at some point in time. Community interventions and services, in this category, this is, again, that middle part of our system. So we've got residential detention where we have care and custody. Now we're moving into the central part of our system for kids that are on probation being served by a number of partners in the community. Again, we've taken great steps with your support to be able to raise the salary for our contracted providers in the care and custody side of our work. But now we want to look at how do we support that middle part of our system with organizations that are providing additional case management, support, and things that they need to stabilize their workforce. And so this is a request to support our contracted providers in this area with an increase in their compensation totaling just a little over $2.4 million. And again, that recurring theme with some of the fixed capital outlay where we have probation offices that, you know, where we have our juvenile probation officers stationed, we have the same things there that we have to do from time to time, replacing carpet, updating bathrooms. You know, when we have pipes break down, we have to move those probation officers out and go to other areas, which sometimes makes it challenging for parents or youth to be able to come in and visit with their probation officer when they need to. So those are all dynamics that we want to continue to address. Then looking at our prevention, you know, side of the budget. I want to thank again the legislature and the governor. We were able to increase compensation for our SNCS providers, which is children in need of services and families in need of services. Some of you had a chance to go out and visit with some of our shelters here as well recently. In those settings, we've got a contract currently that is coming up on 10 years old. We've seen roughly a 36% increase in overall costs since this contract was initiated, and there's been no increase during that time. And so with those costs, we want to try to really build in funding as we're getting ready to move into a procurement for a new contract to go out for competitive bid. But bringing those costs into play with $6.2 million to really address that 10 years of increased cost for doing business, while recognizing that if we don't do that, then the only thing we can do is scale back services. So looking to maintain services and support those services and address those costs over the 10-year period. I mentioned earlier about our evidence-based focus. We want to look at how we leverage things like mentoring. We want to provide more prevention support. Again, I can't talk about addressing the deep end needs of our system and not make sure that we're doing things on the front end to reduce juvenile arrests and contact with our system, because those are our two reasons for existence. Reduce system contact and then reduce recidivism for the kids that come in contact with our system. In this case, we want to bring forward $10 million for competitive grants to expand programs that could be after school programs, summer programs, but also really expand our opportunities around evidence-based mentoring. How do we help connect our youth to, you know, caring individuals that want to support them in their growth and development, and do this in a way that where we can compete, you know, with organizations that have maybe a great footprint in our state, but also address some of those local homegrown organizations that are doing just as good a work that need those opportunities in some of the other areas of the state where we may not have some of those services readily available. But that's where we want to target these dollars to help expand those opportunities here in our state. And then with that, we want to look at adding 6 new positions in the Office of Prevention Services. Over the last, you know, probably 4 or 5 years, we've seen roughly, you know, probably over a 30% increase in funding opportunities coming in through, you know, not just priorities with our, you know, organizations that are already under contract, but sometimes with, you know, legislative initiatives that come forward. And so they're monitoring those programs and going out and trying to provide technical assistance. But during that same period of time, we did have a reduction in 4 FTE about 4 or 5 years ago in this division. We want to bring those back online, add 2 more positions so that we can provide the technical assistance to existing programs or any other initiatives that may come out through the legislature, but also with this opportunity for the additional $10 million in competitive grants to expand prevention services around our state. Then moving into a couple final categories, looking at replacement of motor vehicles. We want to kind of do this in 2 ways. One, we have our existing allocation that helps us to continue to replace vehicles, but right now we have an aging fleet, and in order to really keep up with what we need to do, we can only replace 1 vehicle for every 3 that are about to be surplus, which means before long, we're going to run out of vehicles that we can, you know, use and ensure that they're safe and available, not only for our staff and those that are traveling, but also for the vans that we use for transporting youth, either for detention or for other activities. What we're looking to do is to increase with that 1.4, almost 1.5 million, about half of that being recurring and about half being non-recurring, so that we can replace both fleet vehicles, but also vans that have to have, you know, the infrastructure and the cage and things like that for safety reasons. but looking to replace those vehicles with this additional allocation. And then our last request for expansion of staff or more FTE comes into the area of mental health and medical services and providing that additional oversight so that we can bring on 4 positions in our Office of Health Services to help provide additional oversight, not only in our residential programs, but I would also say supporting our SensFins network. You know, we work very closely with them where sometimes they have youth that are, you know, on medications and going through a number of different supports and things that may be there in the community. But we want to make sure that those services are available across the board, providing oversight, technical assistance that address both the mental health and the medical needs of the youth that we serve. And then finally, IT infrastructure. We are at a point where we've been able to use some unobligated dollars in the past to help address some of our infrastructure needs. We are now at a point, as we've seen, for example, in our residential services, again, those 10-year contracts that we've had to increase the per diem rates, those dollars and things like that that are now obligated, being able to move with this IT infrastructure where every 4 years we could replace laptops. And this helps us put us on a plan so that every 4 years we can really update our technology needs. And much like Secretary Dixon mentioned in his presentation, we have some that can't even, you know, support some of the, you know, newer operating systems that we're going to be required to use. So this is a strategic move to be able to, again, replace about 25% of our laptop inventory every 4 years. And then finally, our juvenile justice information system. This is our case management system that is operated not just with DJJ, but it's operated and used by our court partners, law enforcement partners, and our providers to help make sure that we have information needed on the youth that we serve. We have a system that's over 15 years old. We need to really take the time to look at, you know, through this study that we're requesting, to be able to look at a modernization study to see, do we need to replace that system? Do we need to update it with something new? Or do we need to look at, does it even have the capacity to be cloud-based or not, which I don't believe it does. But with that being said, we want to look at how do we modernize that system, because it really is the backbone of all the information and things that we're using to help support our system when it comes to the needs of our youth, going from the point when a young person might come into our juvenile assessment center all the way through the continuum of our service. This system is really that backbone, and again, it's our case management system at the department. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will pause for any questions.
And thank you very much. Members, are there questions for Secretary Hall? Very short questions. Rep. Campbell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are going to be very short, and thank you for your presentation. Regarding the detention center's budget, how much did you receive towards the fixing up for detentions last session?
You're recognized.
I know I should know that off the top of my head, but I can get you that information. But I can tell you that based on our request, we're trying to make sure that we can make it as whole as possible.
Follow-up.
Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the $27 million that you're asking now, does this now give you the opportunity to fix up those detention centers that you called? I know you said Broward County, and so I'm hoping that that's a good yes for that one.
Right. Great question. So in these two categories, you know, $11 million to help improve the facilities that we have currently. And what we want to start with, and this is about what I would say probably, you know, year-over-year process, the site planning that we have $5 million for this year, is to look at all three of those sites and look at everything from land to architectural design. So our first one, based on age and really overall condition, we would start with Hillsborough, and then our hope would be over the next 2 sessions, come back to replace the next 2, would be part of our goal.
Representative Valdez, do you have a question? A very
yes,
short, very short question.
Definitely.
I'll make
these really short. Thank you, Secretary Hall, for your presentation. I really truly enjoy the visit. Members said that they need to put a little bell to see where I was at, because wherever the kids were, that's where I was at, talking to the children that were in there. And it was uplifting to talk to them and to give them a little ray of hope. My question is goes back to, I just want to clarify that on slide 2, where you're talking about the total base budget for fiscal year, the very first part of it, is that, just to clarify, 23-24, and then the second portion is what you're requesting for 24-25?
Thank you, sir. Great clarification.
Okay.
Absolutely. So the 664 is current base year, and you're absolutely correct. And this
okay.
follow-up is the next fiscal year request.
Follow-up question. when we're talking about the residential bed increase, what matrix did you use to figure out how many beds we needed to increase. I'm hoping that we don't increase beds at all, but I understand.
You're recognized.
Great question. So we look at a couple of things. One, we start to look at the number of commitments that are taking place. We look at changes in the environment, where sometimes we may have a residential provider that has decided if they have like their own facility. We do have one situation where one provider decided to go ahead and pivot from doing a juvenile justice program. And so they took their facility and did not renew their contract. So those are some of the moving dynamics within our portfolio. So those are things that we do monitor, but we first and foremost, we start to monitor commitment trends and look at what's happening along those lines. And then look at our waiting lists, you know, currently, and what are those demands so that we can get kids who are sitting in detention waiting for a bed, be able to get them placed as quickly as possible to start service.
Do we know how many students we have in a waiting list?
I can tell you as of when we did our LBR on July 28th, we had 148 youth on non-secure status sitting in detention waiting for placement.
Okay. And my very last question goes to the staffing of the Office of Health Services. I'm glad to see that we're increasing the registered nurses as well as behavioral. Now, my question is, what's the process if a kid is actually sick? Do we take them to their pediatrician? What are the steps that the RN takes, because they're not able to prescribe medication? So I'm wondering what those dynamics would look like. I hope we don't contract with Centurion. But I don't know how hope we keep that in-house.
You're recognized for a short answer, and if it has to be long, we can probably answer the rep's question offline.
I'll make it really quick. Each of our facilities, residential and detention, they would have a designated health authority who is actually the pediatrician or the you know, the medical professional licensed to do so.
Thank you.
All right. Seeing with no other questions, thank you for your presentation. Very informative.
Mr. Chair.
Presenting today on behalf of the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Commissioner Mark Glass. Commissioner Glass, welcome, and you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair. If I start coughing, I apologize. So, good afternoon, members. I do appreciate this time to be able to come to speak to you about the LBR presentation for Florida Department of Law Enforcement. I also want to say thank you, just like my peers were before me, the amount of work you do for us in law enforcement, we do appreciate it. It doesn't go unnoticed. Our members paid attention for this body, this governing body, and everything that you were able to do for us, and we thank you, and their families thank you, so thank you very much. Now, I just want to say Florida Department of Law Enforcement touches every part. Thank you, sir. Florida Department of Law Enforcement touches every part of criminal justice, to include juvenile justice and also Department of Corrections or Florida Department of Corrections. With that, our agency, by touching everything, we are involved with a lot of different things. So I want to kind of just give you a real rundown of our department here. $361 million is our current base budget with 1,986 full-time employees. General revenue accounts for $199 million, and also our trust fund takes up $162 million. Now, this is where I'm saying we touch everything. We receive $191 million of pass-through federal, state and federal fundings to other criminal justice entities and other things and other projects. Some of these are examples of funds managed by aid law enforcement agencies or drone buyback program, the Florida SAFE program, which is for fentanyl eradication, firearms initiative, and member projects. Not to include, we also include the pay for the fiscally restrained sheriff's offices in counties. For fiscal year 24-25, FDLE is requesting an additional $84 million along with 44 FTE. I know that seems like a lot, but it's we've gone over and looked at our whole agency from top to bottom, and this is what would get us into the right place to complete our mission. This one has four priorities, and this slide here is one of the most important for us. FDLE loses a lot of employees throughout for due to pay issues. This member, this body here, the governor, has done really great things for our sworn staff, and our sworn staff was able to bring that up to 52.5 starting pay. That is, it's wonderful. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement for our special agents, though, we require 6 years of experience. 4 years, at least two of those years, have to be an investigative to do multidisciplinary cases such as RICO, human trafficking, homicides, cold case homicides, large-scale retail theft, election crimes, and major drug trafficking organizations. With that, you have to have the experience, and this is where this is very crucial to us. So looking at the departments around the state, the $4.6 million you see there out of GR and the $1.4 out of trust fund will help us get right with that, so that way we can attract people from out of state to come in with those investigative capabilities. Right now, we compete with everybody else on those, and all the positions you gave us last year, we thank you for that, but we're having a hard time filling them just because we're at the lower end of the spectrum. And I know everybody says that, but we are truly there to run these type of multidisciplinary cases. Also, too, our career progression program is another thing we were looking at. We have FDLE is that 1986 employees, FDLE majority of our employees, three quarters are non-sworn members of the criminal justice community. We are looking at doing a 1.7 in GR and 2.2 in total was reoccurring for the career progression program. We have that in our criminal intelligence analyst program. We have it in our crime lab analyst program, a merit-based program that as you do and accomplish things throughout your career, that you can progress. We utilized the money last year, the $3 million that we got on additional to help in our accounting area, our government operation consultants, our attorneys. But what we need to do is to develop a career progression for them to have, so they will have that longevity piece. And that leads us right into loyalty and longevity. As you see the numbers there for that, these members of our team are the backbone. These are the ones who have stayed through thick and thin, and they're constantly there every day crunching and getting things done. The loyalty and longevity will help us with some of this compression issues that we're dealing with when we raise the cohort on certain things, and thank you again for that last year. We have members that are sitting there beside them 10 years on and who's been there for a long period of time are making the same. And I know we can't fix everything for everybody, but these loyalty and longevity employees, we need them because they are the backbone. And then going back to competitive area differential or critical market pay, the CAD pay has been around for years, for multiple years. FDLE has only one region, which is Miami, that receives CAD pay, but there's more. There's Fort Myers. There's multiple ones. In the critical market pay, other agencies do that. Our non-sworn and sworn folks that are living down in different areas where they have high rent and everything, this will help them. It's really not much that much money for the overall, but it will help us throughout to retain and for longevity. The next one, I just want to show you this one, the increased workload. Why are we losing people? Well, it's increased workload, forensic backlog reduction. We're requesting 6 FT. We have, like I said, this is in addition to the other vacancies we had for a long time. So forensic reduction, we're talking about biology, firearms, friction ridge, which is fingerprint, seized drugs, toxicology. The current backlog number right now is 16,000 for all our laboratory disciplines of backlog. We are losing our lab analysts going to other agencies and private labs, which they're making $10,000, $12,000 more. That's a life changer for most families, especially in some of the other areas. We have the best forensics capability in the nation, the best. We're the third largest DNA database in the nation, but we are losing this to other private companies. And I know we can't compete with private on anything, but we have to get somewhere there where they would want to stay and continue on. When we have the vacancy piece of it, we're adding those extra hours and overtime, and it eventually burns our people out. Another thing, when I came on board as the firearms purchase program, when I came in, there was over 8,000 cases backlogged for firearms purchase program. We changed and we pivoted, and we had all our available members in these different classes to come in and assist in those backlogs to ensure that we're getting these firearm purchases back to the FFL so these people can get their firearms as a constitutional right. We have taken that 8,000 backlog and have now got it down to 2,700. Now with that, we are, like I said, crushing some of the employees. They're coming in, they're doing the mandatory overtime. Some are coming in to do the overtime, but we're getting these cases down. As soon as we let up from that, that will average out to about 5,000 case backlog. So this is one of the main reasons why we're asking that. Public records, we're getting crushed on public records. We're constantly having more and more requests for public records. And the data volume process went from about a 847 gigabyte processing to about a 1.37 terabyte in less than 2 years. We're just getting constantly crushed there. And we're got so many people in the queue and trying to work through it. So these are some of the main issues that we're talking here that we're having problems with. Moving along with investigative and forensic services, FDLE, like I said, is statutorily required to investigate human trafficking, smuggling, and recently we're tasked with investigating retail theft and cyber exploitation cases throughout the state. The first 6 months of these initiatives, FDLE has initiated 25 cases at approximately roughly around $100,000 per case. One of our cases we had over a year ago, which I can just give you an example of 13 Tiers, which was running a sewer 13 gang. Big issue, but that cost us about $800,000 in that case, just on one case. And we had a lot of good, picked off a lot of methamphetamine, picked off a lot of fentanyl, guns, you know, automatic weapons. It was a great case. But just to show you, that's $100,000 per case. Also, too, the law enforcement crime abatement technology enhancement. Now, this big word there is just kind of throwing all the technology issues we had into one and bundling a little bit. But it's IT security organization and enhance our intelligence staffing when it comes to IT and cybersecurity. We all know we're having problems with cybersecurity. Well, FDLE is its own data center. We also, this is how we touch every agency. We run the CJNet, the Criminal Justice Network. We also run CJIS, the Criminal Justice Information Services. You know, we are that touch point for every one of these agencies. So we need to make sure that our data center and everything is up to speed in the IT security. Intercept operation expansion. This is another place we touch every agency, especially in the rural counties, that we actually do investigative techniques to provide the resources to them so that way they can continue on with their cases. Improved fentanyl identification trend monitoring. Remember what I was talking about, the lab. Well, the lab we were talking about, if we do this one, this helps remove some of the limitations we have given to the department's chiefs and sheriffs when they have to do submissions. We have to limit it because otherwise we would be getting even further back on the backlog. We tell them, just give us your top three pieces of evidence so that we can process them, and then once we process them, we'll go to the next three. That way we can do everybody's cases at a decent pace. Cell site simulator. We want to thank you for last year when we got some of this. We only have two more regions for the cell site simulators that helps us with our cases. So we do appreciate that, and this year will be that. Now, the last one I want to talk about was the forensic service expansion. Now, this is a four-year program that I want to present to you today in a request of about, I know this sounds like a lot, and it is, $23 million in 80 FTE over a four-year period. Now, that is to build a centralized, we call it a super lab, to bring in a lot of the DNA and put it in as a part of the state that working with our health organizations, but bringing in to get some of these biologies, such as like UCF, USF, these students that are coming out in forensic technologies, bring them there, and then we have one centralized lab to do a lot of these bigger works. What that does is that frees up our six regional labs to be able to help the sheriffs and the police chiefs to do that touch DNA, because that's what they're hurting for, that, you know, burglaries, and they need that touch DNA. So we can, and also to increase their removing those limitations so they can provide support. So the first year, as you see that one on there, that would be a four-year request. Next one, information IT projects. The BIS, the biometric identification system, touching every one of the agencies. This is the final year for that, and the alcohol testing program. FDLE does that for all the other agencies, as well as the funding for year two of the three upgrade to the Missing Endangered Person Information Clearinghouse, or MEPIC. So that's what's listed there. That's just to finalize those to be done. And we're also requesting funding for outdated systems such as our career offender registry. The career offenders are your worst of the worst. That's your violent criminals that are constantly going in and out. That's the reason why the crime rate in certain areas will go up, because these folks are out there. Well, we're still having to do everything on a triplicate form and then send it in, and then one goes to the sheriff's department, one goes to us, and then we have to upload it into an outdated system. So what we want to do is help the sheriff's departments at the jails and the detention facilities, when these folks come out, and the corrections when they come out, that they can do electronic submission there. One, it helps the career offender, too, so that way they can say where they're at, but also, too, they can update it any time if they move to go find work somewhere else. So that's going to help in the long run. So record management system, we had $500,000 there on a feasibility study we have received last year. We've completed that feasibility study. Our case management system is over 20 years old, and it's on an old ACES system. I got three full-time employees just to keep it up. A lot of Band-Aids on a sucking chest wound. So it is a great, you can't data mine it. It's very hard for us to get information out of it. And for what we're trying to do at FDLE in order to show the information that we have in our systems and being able to share that information, it's very difficult to give it to other agencies for them to have. And last one here is the agency operations. As you see, maintain vehicle fleet of roughly $2 million in GR. When I came in, we're the seventh largest fleet in the state. We didn't have any fleet manager. I brought on a fleet manager. We've been able to go top to bottom and bottom to top and going through all our fleet to make sure that we have the right amount of vehicles. The vehicles are being listed the correct way. And right now, in order to get us out of the hole, we're looking at $900,000 on reoccurring, and we'll be setting pretty good. But this way, we were able to do it. As you can see, the $2 million in body armor, that's coming out of the trust fund. We appreciate that for last year. We're almost getting close to being spent into the $2 million for a lot of law enforcement agencies that couldn't afford body armor. And we'd like to still try to do that another year out of the trust fund to ensure that we're protecting our officers out there. Other than that, that concludes my presentation, pending any of your questions.
Thank you very much. Members, are there any questions? All right, Rep. Campbell, for a very quick question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a very quick question. Thank you for your presentation. One of the questions that I had, you mentioned about your information and technology projects that you got going on. Is your system set up to, are you guys trying to set up your system to where it's communicative to throughout the other systems? So like, say for instance, we're talking about people who are released and trying to have their, make sure that they're paid up so that they can go ahead and live into the real world again. Is that something that you guys are working on with one of your projects?
You're recognized.
You're talking about state Odette? Would that be what you're saying?
Not just debt, but any type of if they have anything. Well, yeah, I guess debt. Yeah.
Yes. On the information technology projects, it's really it's using the existing databases. That database we do not keep, but yes, to be able to have that, and we're able to use that database. But this is more in the internal piece for us because we have some archaic systems in there that need to be addressed. We're at shelf life on it now, so. But I'd be more than happy to talk to you at your office if you want, and you know, further questions on that one.
Thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you, sir.
For our final presentation, presenting on behalf of Florida Commission on Offender Review is Director of External Affairs, Chris Taylor. Good to see you again. You are recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Vice Chair Smith, Ranking Member Valdez, and committee members for providing us the opportunity to present our legislative budget request for the fiscal year 24-25 year. My name is Chris Taylor, and I'm the Director of External Affairs. The Commission performs a vital role in Florida's criminal justice system by preserving the autonomy needed in post-release decisions affecting inmates and ex-offenders, and acts as the investigative arm of the governor and cabinet for clemency matters. The commission provides victims and victim families an opportunity to participate in the decision-making process of the commission and clemency board. The commission also sets conditions for release in order to provide maximum assurance of public safety and ensure swift and certain responses when offenders violate conditions of their supervision, and provides accurate information to ensure informed decision-making by the commission and clemency board. The Commission has one program and five budget activities. The first budget activity is parole and conditional medical release. These are discretionary release types. The second activity is victim services. Victim services are provided during release, revocations, and clemency. The third activity is conditional release and addiction recovery release. These are two non-discretionary release types. The fourth activity is revocations. Under revocations, warrants are issued and quasi-judicial hearings are held. The fifth activity is clemency, and there are eight forms of clemency. And they are a full pardon without firearm authority, pardon for misdemeanor, commutation of sentence, remission of fines and forfeitures, specific authority to own, possess, or use firearms, restoration of civil rights in Florida, and capital case reviews. And this graph just shows the percentages for each of FCOR's activities. The commission is comprised of three commissioners appointed by the governor and cabinet. Currently, we have 161 FTEs that work in our central office in five regions throughout the state. The total base budget is $14,652,079. And this year, we have nine LBR issues. For the first issue, the commission is requesting an armed security guard for commission headquarters in the amount of $61,290 in recurring general revenue funds. The commission is the only central office building within the Capitol Circle office complex that has public access without a security guard. The commission requests funding to hire an armed security guard to protect staff and ensure that unauthorized individuals do not gain access past secure areas. For the second issue, the commission requests a reduction of the trust fund in the amount of $134,454. The commission participated in a federal grant from fiscal year 2004 and 5 through September 30th, 2022. The commission is no longer participating in the grant and requests a reduction in the trust fund authority. For the third issue, the commission requests salary compression for regional administrators, commission investigator supervisors, and commission investigators in the amount of $386,986 in recurring general revenue funds. This request will enable the commission to recruit and retain employees working under increasing demands and conducting multiple in-depth clemency investigations simultaneously. During the last 3 years, the commission has experienced a 35% turnover rate for commission investigators. This turnover rate impacts the ability to have quality investigators and to complete clemency cases. For the fourth issue, the commission requests funding for litigation expenses in the amount of $118,941 in recurring general revenue funds. The commission employs only four attorneys, including its general counsel. Such limited legal staff makes it difficult for the Office of General Counsel to handle protracted litigation or litigation pending and being used outside of Leon County without the aid of outside counsel. The commissioners, the coordinator of executive clemency, the governor and cabinet are regularly named as defendants in clemency-related matters. For the fifth issue, the commission requests vehicle funding for commission headquarters in the amount of $29,921 in non-recurring general revenue funds. The commission is statutorily mandated to hold public hearings at various locations throughout the state each year. Currently, the commission has two cars in its entire fleet. One of the vehicles is 16 years old and does not meet the operational needs of the commission required to carry out its statutory duties and responsibilities. Therefore, the commission requests this funding to replace this vehicle. And I would also like to add that this vehicle just had a rental repair about 2 weeks ago that cost $1,100. For the sixth issue, the commission requests vehicle funding for field offices in the amount of $119,684 in non-recurring general revenue funds. The commission is requesting four vehicles for four of its five regions. Commission investigators at field offices are responsible for routinely traveling to county jails and state correctional institutions to conduct hearings and parole interviews. Commission investigators currently utilize a rental car for travel, causing them to spend a significant amount of travel time picking up and returning the rental car. By providing the field office with a state car in their region, the commission investigators will decrease travel time and increase work productivity. For the seventh issue, the commission requests the conversion of other personal services to full-time equivalent positions in the amount of $216,697. The commission is requesting to transfer this amount from the OPS category to the salary and benefits category. These positions are three OPS, Office of Executive Clemency, Civil Rights Review Specialist 2 positions, and one OPS Revocation Commission Technician 2 position, totaling four FTE positions. Currently, all of the OPS Civil Rights Review Specialist 2s have been employed with the commission for 6 months or less. Fulfillment of this request will enable the commission to recruit and retain employees. For the eighth issue, the commission requests additional clemency positions in the amount of $178,483, of which $11,756 is non-recurring in general revenue funds. Based on the current needs of the Clemency Board, the commission requests two new full-time equivalent government analyst 2 positions, and these positions are required to address increased workload demands. And for the final issue, the commission requests the technology application restoration in the amount of $3,570,000 in general revenue funds, of which $2,338,000 is now recurring. The commission, through a service level agreement, is a customer of the Department of Corrections for all of its IT service needs. Following an assessment conducted by the Department of Corrections, it was determined that the commission has 10 applications that are considered to be legacy because they are beyond the end of life. Each of these applications is critical to the mission of the commission, and an application crash would severely impact and affect the commission's workflow. Without the benefit of these applications, the commission would be forced to revert to manual processing of information, including information submitted to the commissioners and to the governor and cabinet. This concludes my presentation. The chair and my contact information is listed above, and I'll be happy to answer any questions or meet with members individually.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. And for only 2 months at FCOR, you did a superb job. So, Rep. Bracy Davis, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you so much, Director. I had the opportunity, as you know, to attend the commission review hearing in Orlando. It was very insightful and informative and educational. I do have just one question. I see the majority of your budget actually goes to clemency. You talked about there being 8 forms of clemency. How many in this last year, how many persons were able to achieve clemency this past year?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Representative, I do not have that information with me, but I will be happy to follow up with you after the meeting and provide that.
Please do. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. I think we have some public comment. Are you ready? James Biardi. We have to get the proper pronunciation. You are recognized, sir.
Good afternoon, and I'll keep it brief today. I don't want to hold you up any longer, but I heard the Secretary's presentation today, and I agree that we need to fix some of these problems in the physical plant. If I had officers here standing here today, they would tell you that their most important priority is continuance of pay raises. The fact that they're still working large amount of overtime. We heard all three agency heads all talk about how exhausted their staff is. But I just would want you to imagine if you had to do it in the prison, including on your time off. And it's affecting the correctional officers, their personal lives. They're missing, you know, kids' graduations, plays, sporting activities. So all this stuff that the Secretary talked about today, I agree it's important, but I agree it's more important that you stay on the path of fixing the pay of the correctional officers. And the veteran officers are in a very weird situation because now at this point, the newer officers and the veterans are making the same money. It's not only that with the correctional officers, it's that way with the probation officers, it's that way with the ISS officers. For those who don't know who ISS officers are, those are the ones who work, they're correctional officers that work in the state mental facilities. And it's wrong, and it doesn't happen in any other part of law enforcement. Correctional officers work one of the toughest jobs. I know every person sitting here have visited several times, and you know what the correctional officers go through, so you don't really need me up here preaching to it. You know that in your heart, and all they're doing is asking for your help again. It's not their fault that 8 years of abuse happened where they were just constantly, you know, passed up. And it's not your fault either, but you're fixing it. We're thankful for that. We just ask you to stay on that path, keep the funding going, and please remember, we need these veteran officers to teach the new wave of correctional officers how things have to be done in the prison. That's something that all the money you spend, you just can't replace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Lorette Phillipson. You are recognized.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and welcome back, committee members. My name is Lett Phillipson. I'm a resident of Pasco County. The last few days, I've heard and read information on what is being called the Sunset Agreement between the union and FDC. There is no reason that a state should hide state correctional officers' employees' work records through a sunsetting program. While there are some provisions in place for rule violations that do not qualify under the sunset program, as a public servant, records of employees' conducts while employed as a servant of the state should be available to the citizens of the state through public records. The sunsetting agreement would eliminate citizens of the state being able to access certain conduct records under the sunset agreement. No matter how minor the record is, all conduct, including refusal to work overtime or verbal abuse, should still be available to the citizens of Florida if the conduct occurred while on duty. After all, an incarcerated person's record, if found guilty for refusal to work or disrespect, will remain on their record while they're incarcerated. If I am incarcerated in the state of Florida, my prison record is public information on an inmate overall history, DC 14. Yet the state's paid correctional employee of FDC can have their misconduct and work violations expunged. This is not true transparency, and this is once again covering up, hiding, sunsetting it, call it whatever name you choose, but it is allowing the behavior and the culture within the FDC system to continue. As legislators, I am coming to you to ask you to do a better job reviewing FDC's agreements and contracts. There must be someone to oversee the overseers. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Leslie Mata. Making her way forward from the back row.
I'll try to be quick. Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Mata. I have an incarcerated family member. The Florida Department of Correction faces significant budget challenges we're all aware of, particularly in filling positions over time, addressing infrastructure issues and the overpopulation in the southern region. We all share a common goal to ensure the safety of our communities. However, emptying the beds should be a priority going forward. I've had the privilege of speaking to House representatives and senators who have all expressed genuine interest in supporting programs that could facilitate the release of specific groups within our incarcerated population. While an all-encompassing bill for game time would be ideal, I acknowledge the potential challenges it may face. So I propose a different approach. We can make progress by introducing smaller bills that provide opportunities for redemption. The people I've spoken to have suggested these. Veterans, young men raised without fathers, individuals who grew up in foster care, and of course, the aging population that costs more to house. By doing so, we not only reduce the budgetary burden, but also enhance the safety of our communities, as these groups can be set up in programs to help individuals better themselves and rejoin our communities. I urge you to consider the potential benefits of these proposals I've outlined today by opening up beds and making steps towards revamping Florida's prison system. We not only address the budgetary challenges, but we also work towards creating a safer and more just environment for our communities. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next up for public comment, Jackie Dunn. Good to see you again. You are recognized.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. As we all heard here today, well, first of all, let me say kudos to Secretary Dixon and the Department of Corrections. I do believe they're doing the very best that they can with the challenges at hand. My son is incarcerated for almost 19 years for DUI manslaughter at the age of 20. So I have definitely have a vested interest in their well-being and mostly in their progressing as humans. With the trust fund money that they now have to spend on programming, and it'll be nice to see that we change the dial from the 83% that are currently actively not in any kind of programming at any given time within the Department of Corrections, and also would like to see that the 44% that leave prison without their GED, that changes too. We all know that faith and education change lives. We have tens of thousands of people in prison that we are not afraid of. We are only mad at. I urge you to start looking at non-traditional ways to incarcerate and punish people. My son could be on house arrest his entire sentence and pay money to the family. HB 79, the bill that's been introduced to pay child support by DUI manslaughter cases. He could be working full-time and be in prison at night and on the weekends for the rest of his, for his entire sentence, and he'd be better for it, we'd be better for it, the taxpayers would be better for it, and he's not a harm to society. So we've got to stop thinking that, cement and barbed wire is the only way to punish people. It's not good for us. We're sending people out worse than when they came in, and it's costing the taxpayers an absolute fortune. Secretary Dixon didn't mention, but he did in the Senate meeting last week, they've spent $140 million in overtime this year, $30 million on National Guard. I can't even imagine the onboarding cost of turnover of the people that aren't getting paid enough. You know, so let's spend that money paying these guys what they deserve, paying law enforcement what they deserve, bringing in mental health and addiction, instead of incarcerating people that we don't need to incarcerate for $30,000 a year and the 30% of the 85,000 that are over the age of 50, that it triple that cost. So I think we can do a better job of changing the way we punish people.
There we go, thank you. And seeing no other public comment cards, members, Chair Brannon and I appreciate your involvement and attention today and input on these issues that we face as a subcommittee. I would encourage you to spend some time learning the budgets of the departments under our jurisdiction, as well as continue to review each department's request during upcoming subcommittee meetings. If there are any issues that you have questions about or want more information on, please do not hesitate to let Chair Brannon or the staff know. We will attempt to provide you information that you request. I look forward to working with each of you as we move forward in this process. All right, this concludes our committee agenda. Seeing a little bit more business, Ranking Member Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I just made an observation. I want to thank everyone for their presentation today. As I was adding the numbers for the vehicle requests just out of this specific silo, it's over $9 million. So I wonder what the other appropriation committees requests on vehicles are, and I think that it will be something very interesting to see if the department, DMS, would give us an idea as to whether these vehicles should be leased or should we outright purchase these vehicles. Because when you lease a vehicle, the maintenance and things that and certain things are included with that lease, and it might be a little bit more fiscally responsible to do that, considering your opening statements today, that if this might be an opportunity to maybe lump all of the vehicles in one or two contracts and leasing and see what the differences in savings might be. We might not find savings, and it might be that this would be the right way to go, and let's do it. But I would like to see if we can have that information provided to us as we begin to make these decisions on our budget.
I think that's a valid point. I mean, we heard Commissioner Glass talk about one of the first things he did was get a fleet manager. So there's certainly an opportunity for savings, and we have an obligation as a committee to continue to look at that. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Seeing no more business before the committee, Representative Snyder moves. We rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.